You're tuned to WFHB.
Volunteer powered,
listener supported.
Community radio for South Central Indiana.
Good afternoon. Reporting remotely for WFHB, this is Benedict Jones.
And I'm Sydney Foreman. This is the WFHB local news for Wednesday, September 9th, 2020.
And I was, in some ways, one of the key people organizing the protest that happened on August 24th.
Later in the program, you will hear from Pallavi Rowe, a PhD candidate at Indiana University's Media School. She spoke with WFHB correspondent Erin Comforti about her involvement with the Indiana Grad Workers Group and the protests they organized back in August.
Also coming up in the next half hour, Better Beware, your weekly consumer watchdog segment hosted by Richard Fish. But first, your local headlines.
Up first, here are three local headlines you need to know today. WFHB correspondent Erin Comforti filed today's local news brief.
From WFHB, this is the local news brief for Wednesday, September 9th. I'm Erin Comforti. Monroe County reported 36 new cases of COVID-19 on Tuesday. That's according to the Indiana State Department of Health, which reported 720 new positive cases and 17 new deaths in the state since September 4th. Indiana University released new statistics on its COVID-19 testing yesterday evening. Since just before in-person classes started up at its Bloomington campus, the university reported that it has documented over 1,200 positive cases at that campus alone. University policy is that everyone who tests positive has to go into quarantine or isolation, and right now about a third of the university's isolation and quarantine housing stock is in use. Normally, laboratory testing results are posted on the State Health Department's website, but Indiana University's testing results don't appear there. In an email to WFHB, the university claimed that it's reporting all of its testing results to the State Department of Health. In an email exchange with WFHB, the Department of Health did not verify whether it has received testing results from IU and did not respond to the question of why the university's testing results haven't appeared on its website. Monroe County Schools started in-person classes today for the first time since March. The school corporation's decision to open up seems to be at odds with their own COVID-19 reopening guidelines, which state that their primary safety indicator for reopening in-person classes is a percent positivity of all cases in the county under 10%. Despite the school corporation's claim that it was only at 7.4%, on September 6th and 7th, it was actually over 10%, according to the State Health Department. It's unclear how the school corporation arrived at its number. That's all for your local news brief from WFHB. I'm Erin Comforti.
Indiana University Assistant Vice President for Strategic Partnerships, Kirk White, said an increase in COVID-19 cases was detected through 20,000 COVID-19 mitigation tests from IU students and staff. During the September 4th COVID-19 press conference, White presented a concern for rising cases among congregate Greek living facilities.
This has been a difficult situation for us, and particularly for the young men and women who live in those houses. When we understand that, we're doing what we can to support them. But it's also important to note that we're working with their chapter leadership. There are corporation boards that run these chapters that are responsible for their ownership and operation and insurance and things to that effect, and their national organizations. We feel like by helping them navigate this, that they can manage things better for a safer environment. Some of them, a lot of this all depends on the layout of the house, and some of them have facilities that can allow a much reduced number to still live there and quarantine safely. So where that's possible, we can provide advice in coordination with the health department on how that might continue.
White stated IU does not have authority to close Greek living facilities. Monroe County Health Administrator Penny Caudell said Greek house isolation would be safer than sending residents home. White mentioned one resident hall was set aside for student quarantine space. Bloomington Mayor John Hamilton reported low virus prevalence rates from the City of Bloomington Utilities wastewater studies.
The areas of the city that are predominantly non-student housing, so those areas that are predominantly non-student housing, there is little to no virus being detected. Consistent with what you've heard from IU and what we see, the sites that do have detectable or significant levels are consistent with those IU findings centered around student housing facilities both on and off campus.
Caudill said a mass increase in testing could cause a lag in reported results. She reported 33 mandate compliance complaints last week and reminded businesses to publicly post the reopening plans. Caudill said a COVID vaccine is likely to come in 2021.
We don't have a lot of specific details about that vaccine at this time. I can tell you that it looks like it will take two doses, 3 to 4 weeks apart. There will be multiple manufacturers and people will need the same manufactured vaccine each time. And so that does add a level of complexity to getting that vaccine out. So we do continue to work on that. It looks like individuals under 18 and who are pregnant will not be in that first round of vaccine approval. But again, all of that is just what we know at the moment. None of it is written in stone.
IU Health Program Director for Community Relations and Outreach, Shauna Garris, stressed the importance of getting a flu vaccination to preserve healthcare resources. She said Indiana University Health ordered extra vaccinations.
IU Health has ordered an additional 25,000 vaccinations to better serve the community. And every IU Health facility and practice in the South Central region will have vaccines available in addition to 7 flu vaccine sites that are being set up across the region.
Garris reported steady COVID-19 case numbers from the South Central region. She said fewer cases are being reported than at the beginning of August.
The Monroe County Community School Corporation announced earlier this week that it would be moving into code yellow instruction. Monroe County has established a green, yellow, red color scheme for its reopening plan. A code red means all grade levels will be online only. A code green means all grades are open to in-person instruction with an online option. This week's code yellow means different things for different grades. All elementary schools will be offering in-person instruction Monday through Friday. Secondary schools will move into a hybrid schedule with students alternating in-person and digital days based on their last name. For example, students with the last names beginning with L through Z will meet in person today, while students with the last names beginning with A through K will meet online. Students who choose to meet online only can continue to meet online.
Founder of Carbon Neutral Indiana, Daniel Pointer, spoke to the Bloomington Commission on Sustainability during their September 8th meeting. Pointer stated 3 main climate change combaters listed in New York City Mayor Mike Bloomberg's America's Pledge report.
And so every year he puts out this America's Pledge report, and it came out last fall at COP25. And in that report, he basically says, you know, these are the 3 main things that we need to do. We need to do renewable energy. We need to electrify all the things, buildings and cars and so on. And then we need to invest in land use and natural carbon, climate solutions like forests.
Pointer said all states were grouped into 3 tiers and Indiana was in the 3rd tier.
The leaders like California that chart the path for everyone. The followers like Minnesota that follow the leaders. And then the laggards, tier 3. Of which the report expects nothing of us. And I said us because Indiana, according to their analysis, is in tier 3 laggard status. So they're just hoping we don't mess things up. They don't want us to get in the way, basically.
Pointer said carbon pricing covers all solutions. He reported Indiana as one of 10 states that produce half of America's carbon emissions. Pointer said Hoosiers must offset the social cost of carbon.
But basically, researchers at Stanford University wanted to know how bad is it to put carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. We all know it's bad, but how bad is it? That's an economist's question. So their number was $220 of damages for every ton we put in the atmosphere, right? That's the problem. It's just an accounting problem. We're externalizing costs, internalized profits. So in theory, it should be simple. We internalize the costs. And that's what CCL and others advocate for, but we're not going to get that in Indiana anytime soon. So we can do that in a voluntary way. What does that mean? Well, you sit down with a household or a business and you calculate their footprint and you say, okay, Joe Schmo, your household emits 40 tons a year. According to Stanford, which is a pretty good bet, that's $220 of damages a ton, which puts you at about $8,000 of damages, right? You're putting that cost onto others in Bangladesh or wherever. And most people, if they trust you and they follow the math, they don't like that. They want to figure out a way to fix it, right? And that's where carbon offsets come in. Last fall, I thought they were just greenwashing. I didn't know anything about them. But when I ran out of my life savings, I thought, my God, who's going to pay for all these emissions reductions? IU's ERI has a $50 million fund, but a lot of it is for adaptation, right? Some of it's for mitigation, measurement, and so on, but it's not about getting in front of the problem.
Poynter added there are over 200 ways to create carbon offset. He said Carbon Neutral Indiana transformed 5 businesses and 75 houses into carbon neutral buildings, preventing approximately $460,000 in damage. He said currently Indiana does not have any offset projects.
I'm not going to name names, but there's a small company in northern Indiana, maybe 50 or 100 employees. They already pay $60,000 a year for offsets from forests in California. And they told me that in the fall, when the contract is over, they would like that money to go to Indiana projects. Well, guess what? There are no Indiana projects. Not yet. No forest projects anyway. And there's another company that spends a similar amount of money up in northern Indiana on offsets. So right there, there's $100,000 a year that could be going to Indiana farmers or forest owners. So this is the tip of the iceberg of what we could do in Indiana when we take a voluntary approach to take responsibility for our carbon footprints, become carbon neutral.
Poynter said measuring Bloomington's footprint would initiate transformation.
October 5th marks the deadline for voter registration in Indiana. To register, you can go online to indianavoters.com to check your registration, see what candidates are on the ballot, and apply to vote by mail. In addition, you can go online to monroecountyvoters.us to print off an application and send it by mail. You can also register to vote in person at the Monroe County Election Central at 401 West 7th Street, Suite 100. There, you can call 812-349-2690 to request an application. Since the building is currently closed to the public, election officials will hand you an application outside of the building. Vote by mail in Indiana will not look the same as the primary election. No excuse absentee ballots will not be allowed for the election in November. There are 12 reasons you can legally request to vote by mail, which include if you will be out of the country or at work during the entire time that the polls are open. People who are over 65 years old or have a disability are eligible for mail-in voting. The Indiana Election Commission met on August 14th, where it voted down a proposal along party lines to increase voting by mail options. Andy Long, vice chair of the Election Commission, argued that anyone who wants to vote by mail should be allowed to. He wrote a proposal along with Commissioner Susan Overholt Wilson to allow no excuse absentee voting, like in the primary election.
What we are talking about today is the general election and protecting voters so that they are assured of being able to vote without sacrificing their health or risking their health. I mean, that may, under a normal context, that would sound like inflated, you know, hyperbole that's, you know, just trying to, you know, get people excited. But that's a reality right now. That is our reality, that there is no reason to think right now that in November, the situation is going to be better than it is now. In fact, if you listen to the news, they're saying that as soon as the weather gets colder and people are inside more, there's a concern that the numbers are going to get worse. And we all know that when you're running elections, you can't wait until the day before, the week before, to say, oh, golly, let's make some changes here so people can vote from home.
Commissioner Zach Klutz countered Wilson's statement by saying that Governor Holcomb's stay-at-home order has since expired and that Hoosiers should vote in person.
Well, I'll just simply say that just because these orders were agreed upon for the primary doesn't necessarily mean that the factors giving rise to that, at least for the purposes of why I voted for them for the primary, are still in existence. Specifically, those modifications to the election procedures were done immediately after the stay-at-home order was issued by the governor, and us not knowing how long that stay-at-home order would be in existence. We still are dealing with a pandemic, but the factors have changed, and we've come to understand this pandemic a little bit better, understand how to protect ourselves. I mean, case in point, we are now in stage 4.5 of a five-stage back on track plan. We weren't there in May, and we are, or in March, quite honestly, I'm sorry, March, and we are much further down the road now. So just because something was agreed upon in March because of an emergency doesn't mean those same factors automatically make this appropriate this time.
If you are eligible to vote by mail, it's recommended you request a ballot as soon as possible. The deadline for requesting an absentee ballot is October 22nd. Now it's time for your feature reports. Up first, you will hear from Pallavi Rowe, a PhD candidate at Indiana University's Media School. She spoke with WFHB correspondent Aaron Comforti about her involvement with the Indiana Grad Workers Group and the protest they organized back in August. Here now is that interview.
What exactly do you do with the Indiana Grad Workers?
I've been a member of the coalition and have attended several of their meetings. I'm not a member of the core team, but the core team keeps changing. And I was, in some ways, one of the key people organizing the protests that happened on August 24th, which was the car parade and the Dunn Meadow sort of socially distanced protests. One of the things that Indiana Grad Workers has been asking for over a year now has been a sort of increase to our annual wages as graduate workers. Many of us are PhD students and master's students who also teach courses and are teaching assistants or AIs for IU. And the base stipend that we make is only about $16,000, which is well below what the standard of living in Bloomington is. And on top of that, we actually use part of our income to pay fees back to the university. So last year, I think from summer onwards, Indiana Grad Workers Coalition was actually lobbying to end the fees. They had an end the fees campaign that went all year round. They had a march in the middle of the year. And I sort of got involved with the protests and things like that, because as an international student, not only do I pay the mandatory fees, which include things like, you know, transportation, technology fees, recreational fees, and so on, we also have an international fee that is meant to cover some of the paperwork and some of the labor that goes into the paperwork to maintain our visa status here. And that number has been increasing every year. So, you know, the fees add an extra financial burden for us on an already existing sort of very minimum wage. In many ways, I've been involved with the coalition for those reasons. But over summer, we also had a number of incidents that sort of demonstrated our precarity. So I live on campus. Briefly, there were some fears that on-campus housing would evict us when COVID was declared and the university kind of went fully online in March. Luckily, there was a petition process, but we had a few fraught days where we really weren't sure whether we'd be asked to leave or not. And as I'm an international student and international flights were grounded, I don't really have a place to go, right? So that was one aspect of that stress. The second was the ICE ruling on, I think it was on July 7th, the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency declared that if your schools were going fully online, students on an F1 visa, which is the category of visa that I'm under, would not be allowed to stay on in the United States because online courses are not a part of our visa regulations. Basically, if we come to the US, we have to be enrolled in in-person classes. So this was kind of a bit of a shock because many of our universities were still debating whether they were going fully online or not. IU declared that they were hybrid, but if the courses we were signing up for were only online, we could possibly be deported. And so that was what led to the protest on August 24th. And I kind of assisted with some of the logistics of having people participate in Dunn Meadow.
The protest was specifically about ending the fees, and it was also about raising compensation for graduate students, as I understand it. How do grad students deal with earning $16,000, which isn't enough to cover, in many cases, basic expenses?
There were four main demands of the protest. One of the main ones was to increase our wages to a living wage. The number that we came up with was 21,772. This was actually not calculated by us, but actually based off of one of the Student Central websites, which actually advises incoming students about estimated costs of living in Bloomington. For graduate students, the Student Central website actually clearly states that you can expect to spend about $21,772 to actually live in Bloomington annually. So in some ways, we were like, well, if IU's own website is saying that this is the amount required, then they should obviously be able to match that when they're actually, deciding what the base pay stipend is for graduate workers living here. So that was the number that we reached. So number one was making a living wage of $21,772. The second was we wanted yearly increases, because for all of us who lived in Bloomington, we see inflation has meant that our rent has risen. You know, I'm spending about $100 more per month to rent the same apartment that I've been living in for 5 years. That adds up to nearly $1,200 more a year now than it did when I landed here. But my pay has not seen an increase in that time. We want yearly increases to adjust for inflation. The third is waiving the fees. We are reiterating the demand, especially because now this year IU has actually sort of collapsed all the mandatory fees into one lump sum, meaning we actually don't have a breakdown of what our fees are actually paying for. While some mandatory fees have been waived, others have not, and now we don't even know which ones have. And like I said, the international fee remains exorbitantly high. And then the last one is that we would like IU administration to let graduate workers decide whether they want to teach online or in person and not have that be stipulated by the department. So many of us, for instance, our departments, we've been, organizing within our departments to demand that, if we don't feel comfortable to go back into the classroom and teach in the middle of COVID, we should be allowed to then decide whether we want to stay online or not. And some of our departments have accommodated us, but there are some courses which departments insist are going to have to be taught in person. And so graduate workers are being asked to turn up and actually teach them. And if they refuse, obviously their funding and, continued progress in the program becomes sort of questionable. Now, about what you said about the jobs. So these were the four demands for the protest. Now, what you said about extra jobs, yes. Many, many grad students do take a second or third job to actually supplement their income. But I will say, as an international worker, I'm not allowed to work off campus. One of the rules of my F1 visa is I am only allowed to do 20 hours of work in the semester on campus. If I even exceed the 20 hours, actually, I will need permission from my department to explain why I'm doing extra work. So yeah, many of us have literally lived on the verge of being broke all the time.
And what do you say to the university administrators who say, before all of this can happen, we have to get through COVID, because they announced essentially a hiring freeze and a raise freeze for just about anybody? What would you say to an administrator who would put that to you?
Well, one of the things that we've really tried to sort of educate ourselves on is trying to understand how IU spends its money, right? IU had a bicentennial last year where they very proudly declared that they'd raised close to $4.5 billion through donors and alumni and things like that. So in some ways, we're kind of wondering, well, you had such a good year with fundraising. You've managed to gather all of this money. And then COVID hit. With any organization, you would think it makes sense then that amount of money that you've raised will then go towards buffering some of the costs that COVID is going to bring to you. IU has insisted on opening up the campus for all undergrads and bringing them back onto campus and trusting them to actually, socially distance and be sort of responsible adults who don't, engage in sort of community spreading and things like that. One of the justifications, of course, is that it's financial, right? They want students to be on campus to keep the local economy alive. Dorm fees and things like that will continue to pay for what IU does. And we do know that IU's actual profits come from student tuition, right? So in some ways, these are things that we've gathered have been happening over the last 1.5 years. And we're constantly surprised by the fact that IU keeps saying that, the funds have to be directed to more important things. Earlier this year, they put up a $7 million bell tower in the middle of campus, a campus that was very quickly evacuated in the middle of COVID. And we see construction projects happening all the time across campus as well. But every time we ask for a raise in our wages, or, you know, and we're talking about minimal increases to our wages, which are actually commensurate with, you know, yearly bonuses and things like that. That hasn't happened. And then, you know, recently, I think the IDF had a report that actually said that coaches and some of the other administrators at IU actually had a pay rise this year. To us, it's always like we seem to be last on the list of priorities. And yet, you know, in the middle of COVID, close to 40% of teaching on this campus is sustained by graduate workers, assistant instructors, and instructors who are PhD or MA students.
So let me get that straight. Grad students teach 40% of classes on the IU Bloomington campus, and they're making $16,000 a year?
Yes. So that amount may vary depending on the department, and we're not often guaranteed summer funding. For instance, over the last 4 years that I've been in the media school, I have not received any summer funding, which means my last paycheck comes in May at the end of the academic year, and then I have to wait until August until my next paycheck comes and make sure I sort of budget myself.
And what's next? Are there any more protests planned or any further actions?
We're certainly not going to stop right now because we still haven't heard back from the university. And this is not we are far from alone in this, right? Just today, I actually read that the University of Michigan had what they called a die-in protest.
Well, I hope we get to speak in the future and get an update on what the Indiana grad workers are doing and the state of grad students and international grad students at IU. Thank you so much for taking the time to come on the local news on WFHB.
Yes, thank you very much.
You've been listening to the WFHB Local News. Today's headlines were written by Aaron Comforti, Jake Jacobson, Cade Young, and Sydney Foreman in partnership with CATS, Community Access Television Services. Our feature was produced by Aaron Comforti.
Our theme music is provided by Mark Bingham and the Social Climbers. Our engineer and executive producer is Cade Young. For WFHB, I'm Sydney Foreman.
And I'm Benedict Jones. Thanks for supporting Indiana's only volunteer-powered, listener-supported, independent local news program. You can hear tonight's full broadcast, as well as all other WFHB news programming online at WFHB.org.
You too can be a part of our award-winning news team. For more information about joining our volunteer team of citizen journalists, email news at WFHB.org.
Stay tuned for the Transmission Times, coming up next on WFHB Community Radio.
You've been listening to the WFHB local news on WFHB Community Radio. Our news is written and reported by volunteers working to provide local news, cover local issues, and strengthen our local community. We invite you to participate. You may submit questions, comments, and story ideas to news at WFHB.org. You can become a WFHB local news volunteer by attending new volunteer orientation. Feel free to check out the WFHB local news archive at WFHB.org to find newscasts, individual stories, and catch a live feed of the WFHB local news. We are local, longer,